Инновации – это творчество.
Необходима всесторонняя модернизация.
Пользователей интернета.
Высоких технологий работы.
Вообще информационные технологии – это один из...
Развитие гражданских и экономических
свобод. Freedom is better than non-freedom.
Ah, freedom is better than non-freedom. Remember that? How about when iPads were all the rage for Russian officials? Or when the Skolkovo Scientific Center was going to spearhead innovation that would modernize the Russian economy? Yup, the four-year interlude that was Dmitry Medvedev's odd little interim presidency looks positively quaint today. And if there was ever any doubt that Vladimir Putin is determined to airbrush it from history, it ended this week when the investigative committee announced it was launching an embezzlement probe into the Skolkovo Center, a direct hit on the showcase project of Medvedev's modernization program. That came just weeks after investigative committee agents searched the offices of Kirov governor Nikita Bilyk, a man Medvedev plucked from the opposition and brought into the elite. It was a move widely seen as part of an effort to bring some fresh air, if not some degree of pluralism, into an ossified political system. The back-to-back attacks on Bilyk and Skolkovo can be interpreted as direct hits on two of the pillars of what I will call, for lack of a better term, Medvedevism. A clumsy, half-hearted, four-year effort to diversify the Russian economy and reform the political system. And now that this weak little mini-thaw is clearly over, a question remains. What was the point of all that anyway? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Kirill Coburn is off for another week, but on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, a longtime Kremlin watcher, and author of the must-read blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, Mark, we've talked on this podcast a lot about Medvedev. We've looked at his chances for political survival. We've evaluated his government's performance. We've even made fun of him a little bit. A little more than a little bit. But what I wanted to do today is go beyond the man and look at the era he presided over and what it represented or represents. Medvedevism, this term we're going to use to describe what he was apparently trying to do, it didn't appear out of nowhere. And actually, it had very little to do with Medvedev himself. Medvedev was meant to be nothing more than a placeholder for Putin. But his presidency took on a specific shape and a specific tone. And that had consequences. And those consequences are still being felt despite Putin's best efforts. It raised expectations. People in the regime had a stake in it. What do you think? What was Medvedevism all about? Was it an accident, a ruse, an abandoned experiment, a power play by one part of the elite, a fake president gone rogue? What was that four-year period all about, do you think?
Well, in many ways, it was all of the above. It's quite interesting, actually. Out of curiosity, I Googled Medvedevism, and it came up with not a single hit, whereas even Kudrinism had 8 hits. Which is perhaps a rather depressing little coda for him. Now, I mean, I think what we need to think of when we look at this interlude is that, yes, on the one hand, it was very much instrumental. It was the decision not to change the laws of the constitution to allow Putin to stand again so that he could show that he was legitimate and such like, and, as you say, a placeholder. Secondly, it was also an attempt to use that opportunity to precisely rebuild or expand the social base of the Putin regime by bringing in someone who could appeal to a slightly different segment of the electorate and also present a different face of Russia to the outside world. So it was an attempt to basically have its cake and eat it from the point of view of the elite. They had someone who looked more liberal. They had someone who could sort of talk the sort of technological, white heat of technology, slightly more sort of soft and cuddly kind of rhetoric, while maintaining sort of very much power in Putin's hands. But I think the point is these are all the grand plans. However, they also broke down in two ways. One is just that Medvedev himself changed one office. You can't put someone behind the big desk in the Kremlin even if it's made clear to them at the beginning that they should regard themselves as merely the sock puppet, and not have that affect him. And therefore, I think certainly in the sort of first couple of years, there was a sense which actually Medvedev himself was pushing his agenda, and maybe even feeling out the possibilities for a stab at the presidential elections himself. But secondly, there are many around him and many elites who precisely use the opportunity. In this way, it's a little bit like Glasnost and the whole sort of Gorbachev experiment, is that what starts as an initiative from above then gets picked up by other actors and interest groups to sort of push their own interests. So I think it's a classic sort of mix of a cunning plan devised by backroom political technologists, an individual who just simply, once in a position of power, wants to see how he can use and extend that power, and lots of different interests thinking, well, okay, how can we use this opportunity to our own advantage?
Can this genie be put back in the bottle? Because we've talked a lot on this podcast about how weak Medvedev is, and he is weak, and he was a weak president. But despite of that weakness, or perhaps because of it, for reasons you just outlined here, it unleashed forces. It unleashed forces within the elite. People like Dvorkovich, who believe in this modernization stuff, right? People like Surkov, who for, I would think, more cynical reasons, believe that you did need to introduce some managed pluralism, if for no other reason to keep the current elite in power. It unleashed forces in society because expectations were raised. Everybody makes fun of freedom is better than non-freedom, right? But as a result, you did see an awakening in civil society, and the seeds of that awakening were sown during this odd little interim period of the Medvedev presidency. Can this genie be put back in the bottle now? You can get rid of Medvedev easy with a stroke of a pen. You can get rid of Medvedev. Can you get rid of Medvedevism? Or the aftershocks of Medvedevism, I guess, to put it more correctly.
I don't think you can, for the very reason that actually Medvedev did not create these forces. Why Medvedev had an impact that is rather disproportionate to his own character is precisely because he was actually reflecting and then in process amplifying movements that were already taking place. There was the rise of this new middle class that didn't really have a stake in the existing Putinist status quo, but on the other hand had a voice and ability to mobilize and was based in Moscow and other main cities. There is a clear objective need to diversify the Russian economy away from its current dependence on hydrocarbons. All of these issues, there is a growing awareness of the insidious impact of corruption. These are not things that Medvedev just sort of conjured out of nowhere. Instead, the whole point about the Medvedev experiment was that, well, we can bleed off the pressures that they create by having a front man who seems to be saying the right things, by having a few minor gestures to address them. Well, it didn't work. It didn't work in the sense of it didn't actually end the various political sort of and economic dilemmas facing Russia. But on the other hand, what it did mean is that what was implicit now became explicit. In some ways, I mean, the real message of the Medvedev regime is that change is better than non-change. And that's a lot harder to actually sort of dispel. So no, I mean, I don't think the genie is going back into the bottle. But nor do I actually think sort of Medvedev was the one necessarily who uncorked him. Medvedev was the first person who hoped the genie could give him a wish. but that genie was coming out regardless.
So this presidency, as much as we ridicule it, was actually quite consequential.
It was. It was consequential, I would say, firstly for the things Medvedev did. And I think, I think it's worth just dwelling for a moment, however much exactly I ridiculed him. Medvedev did do things. Medvedev did and does believe in things. And I think one of the obvious examples is his emphasis on a law-based state. He and Putin were both trained as lawyers at university. It only seems to have stuck with him. Medvedev does seem to have this view that even authoritarian regimes should have laws and should observe those laws in the main. For example, if you look at sort of the law on the Federal Security Service that he passed, on the one hand, it's not a liberal document. We shouldn't think of Medvedev as a liberal, But it's a legalistic document. It actually sort of does say, look, there really ought to be genuine checks and balances and controls and limits. And as soon as you set those lines, you are inviting people to then challenge the FSB when it breaks those laws. So, I mean, I think that is something that we can sort of say was definitely an impact of Medvedev, and I think it does have a stake. I mean, if one looks nowadays at one of the interesting things that the opposition movement has often done, which is precisely to try and make sure that everyone knows the laws for when the cops come and start, you know, throwing them into the
wagons.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry.
The Aftozak, as they're called.
Exactly. It's that whole sense of actually sort of constraining the state, which was always kind of anathema to Putin, that I think actually now does have much more traction. So there are things that Medvedev did, as well as the sort of Skolkova and other sort of showpiece things. But precisely, I think much of his strength was precisely what he didn't do. That he allowed a lot of discussion and debate to develop under him that couldn't then be suddenly sort of rolled back because it wasn't a state project, that discussion and debate.
Another thing he did that I would add, too, is, and we're still feeling the repercussions of this now, is his personnel policy. He promoted a lot of younger people. I used to play on the blog a little bit with the conflict between the Siloviki, and we know what they are, and the Siviliki, the people with backgrounds in civil law, a lot of them, Konovalov, the justice minister, for example, who's a law school classmate of Medvedev. But not just at the ministerial level. Throughout the lower rungs of the bureaucracy, there's a lot of people now in the state apparatus that owe their jobs to Medvedev, that are still there, and that are forming, like, the backbone of the kind of inter-elite opposition, if you will. And there's been speculation that they're cooperating with the external opposition as well. One thing I did that does strike me about this, if Putin and his political managers set this thing up and it started to go off the rails in ways they didn't like, why didn't they shut it down? And let's take two examples here. Skolkovo was all about the modernization and diversification of the economy. It was the showcase project of that. That meant diversifying the economy away from hydrocarbons, away from commodities, away from oil and gas, right? That goes directly against the interests of very powerful people like Sechin and other Siloviki, who are tied closely to the oil and gas industry. Allowing a degree of, albeit managed, but managed pluralism within the system went against the interests of the Siloviki, who wanted to keep the political system centralized. Why didn't Putin move to shut this down earlier? Because it would have been much easier to put that genie back in the bottle back in 2009, for example, and make it clear at least to the elite that this presidency is a fake presidency. But Putin let the ruse go on, which led a lot of people, myself included, to think the plan might be something else. And as we've talked about before, it might be to keep Medvedev in and let Putin play this kind of Deng Xiaoping national leader role. We remember we used to discuss that a lot when there was a lot of, and I think that was what Surkov and Pavlovsky and others wanted the plan to be. But if Putin never intended to do that, why didn't he shut this down earlier? Or did he change his mind at some point in the process?
Well, we've talked about this, particularly sort of in context of the whole castling venture, and I believe that actually Putin did change his mind. Either he had decided that he was happy remaining in the shadows, or at least he was willing to keep that as one of the plans in operation. And to do that, he has to have at least a halfway credible president. I don't really think that Putin is very good at contemplating the long-term socio-economic possibilities. He's very good on elite politics. I don't think he's good at the big politics around him. He depends on others for that. So I think that it took quite some time for it to really percolate to Putin and, more to the point, those around him, the extent to which making a show of a more technocratic, diversified, legalistic sort of approach to politics really would matter. I think at first they just think, look, you know, we'll just let Medvedev say his stuff. We know where real power lies. I think they took a while to realize the extent to which symbolic gestures can have real power in the long term. So I think that's why he was allowed to get away with it. But also, I mean, let's be honest, a lot of what Medvedev did does go with the grain. I mean, take Skolkova. Look, it's easy to think this is just a kind of a Potemkin science park from a Potemkin president, but Skolkova is not going to recraft the Russian economy overnight. In many ways, Skolkova is in some ways closest to those kind of the sort of Sharashka deep secret Soviet science institutes at which they desperately try and catch up with the West. It may well have certain technological implications. We're probably going to see sort of spin-off software companies and such like. But, you know, a handful of nerds coming up with some nice new games or antiviral software is not going to suddenly wean Russia off dependence on hydrocarbons. Skolkova is not a threat to the sort of the Sechin power elite. The problem, I mean, Skolkova becomes a threat precisely because of its symbolic importance. When actually you suddenly realize that having Skolkova is not just a, oh, let's graft on some high tech onto our economy. It's actually admitting our economy is really phenomenally backward. Our industry is in decline. The only reason that our economy is staying afloat is precisely because of oil and gas exports. And therefore, this actually speaks to a deeper malaise in the governments of the country. But that's a sort of a message that takes time to really begin to percolate. And I think that's why at first Skolkova seemed a great idea, even to the sort of Silovik types who saw it just simply as a route to shiny new weapons. But then in long term, they suddenly think, okay, maybe it's not so great.
So I guess what I'm hearing here, and we're going to talk about Medvedevism, but we're learning a lot about Putin here. We're bringing out a lot about Putin. He's a great tactician, but he appears to be a horrible strategist. Would you agree?
I would. He's in his first couple of terms, he was a very, very, very lead tactician, and in a way that meant he didn't need to be much of a strategist. And he also subcontracted strategy to the Surkovs and Kudrins and so forth.
The Skolkovo was symbolic of one aspect of the Medvedev experiment, the modernization half. What about the games that were being played with political pluralism? Because this is the other half of the game that was going on. And I talked at the outset about Bielik, and that's just one example of some of the things that was going on that were going on in the Kremlin during the Medvedev presidency. The idea to my first reaction to this was very cynical. Okay, they're just trying to co-opt part of the elite to neuter them. But over time, my thinking evolved and said, no, this isn't exactly what's going on. They are trying to create this kind of contained competition within the political system to siphon off, as you said earlier, this discontent in society, this mounting discontent in society. There was the Prokhorov project of Right Cause, which was an outgrowth of the whole Bielik experiment to create a center right party that was manageable within the system. Putin let this thing go, too. This brought, for a time, Surkov, who was deputy Kremlin chief of staff and chief ideologist, in direct conflict with Boris Gryzlov, at the time the head of the United Russia Party. Because what did this mean, basically? United Russia was going to be maybe first among equals, but they weren't going to be the only dog in the kennel. There was going to be a bunch of others as well. And United Russia didn't like that and resisted it and fought it and ultimately won that argument. But Putin let this thing go on for a while, again raising expectations. Is this just another example of him being a bad strategist and a good tactician?
Yes, I think so. I definitely agree with how you characterize the situation. But if we think about it, whereas Putin and the notion of the power vertical sort of implies a certain monolithic nature, in fact, Putin has often, ruled precisely by playing off institutions and individuals against each other. It's your classic sort of style. Whether we're looking at the security apparatuses, he's happy to let these turf wars explode between the FSB, the Interior Ministry, the Anti-Narcotics Service, and then steps in after a certain point when it begins to look as if it's getting out of hand. Likewise, I think Putin has always had this notion that a bit of competition is a handy thing. I just think that from his point of view, he regarded it as an extension of such, that actually a bit of political competition is a good way of co-opting people, perhaps bringing in new ideas in a very controlled and contained manner, but only in order to strengthen the central system. But again, I think it's one of these things that tactically sounds great. In practical terms, it can often be very, very problematic. Because the difference is that your miscellaneous Silovik types, however much they feud, they have a very, very key common shared interest in the status quo. Whereas actually, if you start bringing in these political outsiders, they might well be considering different kinds of sort of outcomes, that they don't need Putin, or they don't even need Putinism. So yeah, I mean, I think it was one of these sort of tactical, what seemed like a good idea, that strategically was actually quite dangerous. Mm.
And judging from what I was reading in the Russian press, Putin was never happy about the Bielik move. It's unclear what he felt about this, creating this center-right party within the Duma. The mastermind behind this whole project, of course, was Vladislav Surkov. And I'm still trying to figure out what his motivations were strategically. Tactically, it was very clear what his motivations were, to create this contained, managed pluralism. But did he see this, and we don't know the answer to this, as just the means to keep this elite in power, to prolong Putinism? Or was it a stepping stone to evolve beyond Putinism? And that much is unclear right now. I don't expect you to have... Do you have any thoughts on that yourself? I'm still trying to figure it out myself.
To be honest, you're much, much more of a committed Surkov watcher than me.
I'm fascinated with the man.
I certainly wouldn't want to try and sort of tell you anything. I can't help but feel that maybe... And I should have Googled this one. Maybe really what we're talking about is not so much Medvedevism
but
as
Surkovism.
And that the sort of the Medvedev regime was in much more of a Surkovian one than we might have thought. Because yeah, I think that on the one hand, this is a man who uses his dark political skills in order to maintain the Putin regime while he's Putin's man. But on the other hand, I certainly do not think this is a man who doesn't have a sense of the world and a sense of the ways in which he wants to nudge Russia. You very few people are that devoid of ego that in that situation they don't feel they have some stake. And I certainly never got the sense that ego was a problem for Surkov.
No, I definitely don't get that sense.
I think that sort of, as it were, he interprets his loyalty to Putin and Putinism and the current state-building project in perhaps more sort of... freewheeling terms than Putin. Mm-hmm. And I think he is thinking, well, this is the way we want to go. He wants it to be a slow evolutionary process. But I do think that he wants to see change rather than simply stasis.
He's obviously a good strategist, but he proved to not be a great tactician because he got outmaneuvered by Volodin. Mm-hmm. Although his absence from the Kremlin now is visible. The tactics have changed. They're not so subtle anymore. They're not so nuanced anymore. They're beat you over the head with a baseball bat. And that's Volodin's style, where Surkov would charm and cajole and co-opt and, you know, get you to do what he wanted you to do. And you'd be thinking it's what you wanted to do. Going back to Medvedev and Medvedevism, we both expect Medvedev to be gone. Soon enough, right? Sooner or later. What happens to Medvedevism now? Does somebody pick up this mantle and become the vessel of it? Because Medvedev clearly, since September 2011, was no longer the vessel anymore. It's unclear if who's going to pick it up. What do you see happening to this tendency now?
In many ways, this really sort of links back to the conversation that we had about who would succeed Medvedev. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the problems. It's really not clear. We aren't in a position to actually say what's going on within Putin's head. If we, however unlikely it is, saw, for example, a Kudrin premiership, then one could say that, you know, although clearly sort of Kudrin's approaches are very different from Medvedev's, nonetheless, the strategic decision has been made that they have to be, shall we say, reformist conservatives. It's the old smart conservatives, reform that you may preserve sort of mantra, that there's no point just simply trying to kind of keep things fixed. You actually have to sort of find out ways of trying to manage change. So that's route one. And then route two is the rather more sort of conventional, no, we just hold the line. And exactly, sort of, anyone who tries to cross that will beat them back. I honestly don't know at this stage, because we are getting quite contradictory signals. On the one hand, there's a lot of small-scale, conservative, reactionary, frankly, regressive stuff happening, which would seem to imply that at the moment the decision is just to hold the line, which is, after all, the easiest default position. But on the other hand, I don't think we've yet seen, you know, for example, with Skolkova, there's an anti-corruption investigation, but we're not seeing people saying we've got to close it down. We're not seeing people seriously arguing that Russia does not need to modernize. I think this is the problem, that actually Putin doesn't know what to do, and I think, and he's not someone who likes to act when he's not, he doesn't feel confident of what the outcome's going
to
be.
Although they're not saying we don't need to not modernize, but they're not modernizing. I don't see any action happening on that. I see basically the status quo. Would you agree?
Yeah, exactly, because it comes down to this relative paralysis that's taking place. Russia could seek to modernize, but to do that, it would have to divert power and resources away from where they currently are.
Right.
And to do that, that means Putin is going to have to say to the hydrocarbon elite, I'm afraid that your featherbed era is over. He would actually have to start empowering new elements of the elite. Again, this is what I'm saying. It's a decision. These are all strategic decisions that have their time is still there. He could do these things. Whether he would be able to successfully manage change is another matter. That's always the hardest thing to do. He hasn't ruled it out, but nor has he ruled it in. So at the moment, we do have this period of drift.
Right. It's almost as if, to play with the historical analogies, taking advantage of the fact that Kirill is not here, you raised the Gorbachev analogy. It's almost like, Medvedev is almost Khrushchev, the thaw that failed, and we're waiting for the thaw that's going to be the real deal. And maybe the next one is what it's going to be. But that, now we had, 20 years between those two. Time is a little bit sped up in our era, so it may come quicker. But do you think it's going to be in another period that this comes, or is it going to come on the heels of this period, do you think?
I think we're much closer than during the Khrushchev era. I mean, let's face it. I mean, Khrushchev, in many ways, for all his sort of image as being the de-Stalinizing figure, he was as bloody-handed a lieutenant of Stalin's as any. And in many ways, he and the elite wanted, I hesitate to say Stalinism without Stalin, but there was a very, very limited form of modernization that they were looking for. And they could do it because precisely they were inheriting this incredibly controlled system. The point is, now we do not have that. The effect of the Medvedev era has been precisely to liberate a lot more forces.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you add that to the impact of everything from social media to the rise of a new sort of creative and managerial class and such like, and this is a very, very different environment. So no, I certainly don't think that we're talking about that kind of a long durée. The question will really simply be whether or not Putin or shall I say, the Kremlin, to give this like sort of broader context, or the collective Putin, the deep state, whatever, seeks to try to control this pretty much inevitable transition, or tries King Canute-like to sort of keep the waves back, which will ultimately lead to a failure and potentially a rather nasty failure.
Right. Those are their only two choices, in my opinion, because the forces that led to Medvedevism were basically, to use Marxian terms, basically objective economic factors. I mean, as you pointed out, the economy must be diversified, or else Russia is doomed to this forever boom and bust cycle at the mercy of commodities prices. But when you, the minute you do that, it has political implications, and those political implications, like it or not, are greater pluralism. And even in the boom cycles of the oil economy, as we're learning now with the emergence of this new middle class, that has repercussions because it creates a middle class that begins to demand political rights. These things are not going away. Putin cannot wish them away. He cannot decree them away. He's going to have to face them or ignore them at his own peril. So I think this change is coming. It's just the question is, what form is it going to take, right?
Yeah, and how Putin responds to it. I mean, I think history is non-negotiable, but the ways in which elites respond to that history is really the biggest challenge for them. The boom cycle, shall we say, and just simply the the political benefit from actually being a president who could walk under his own steam and wasn't an alcoholic. It meant that Putin had this charmed first existence. And I think that left him with a ridiculously exaggerated sense of actually how much power resides within the Kremlin. Now he's having to cope with a situation, you know, a more normal situation, a situation, in fact, in which political leaderships usually have to operate, which is actually that, you know, the world is a difficult and complex place, and it's really just a question of how you respond to events. At the moment, Putin's not proving particularly good at that.
Right. No, I think you put it very well in last week's podcast when you say sometimes times change, but leaders don't. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. Well, in a few moments, we will shift gears and take a look at something I never thought I would see. Vladimir Putin and his nemesis, Alexei Navalny, singing from the same song sheet, sort of. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line with me from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russian security services, and author of the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
I love Russia. Because it is impossible not to love Russia. I'm Russian, and like any Russian person, I love my motherland.
He has the audacity to head the Duma's ethics committee and write his horrible hypocritical ethics codes and constantly speak against the dominance of foreign agents. But it turns out that he buys elite real estate in Miami.
President Vladimir Putin sent legislation to the State Duma this week forbidding certain categories of Russian officials from having assets abroad. And not everybody in the ruling United Russia Party is happy about that. But one person who seems to be having the time of his life with it is anti-corruption blogger and opposition figure Alexei Navalny, who's been busy digging up undeclared foreign holdings of people like United Russia lawmaker Vladimir Pekhtin. Pekhtin was forced to resign as chairman of the State Duma's, and don't laugh, the State Duma's Ethics Committee when Navalny dug up his real estate holdings in the state of Florida. Just how bizarre this whole episode became evident when the state-run Channel 1 gave Navalny credit on the air for uncovering Pekhtin's real estate holdings in Florida. Let's just briefly listen to that clip because it's priceless.
Отмечу, что информацию о имеющейся Пекхтина о зарубежной недвижимости опубликовал в своем блоге Алексей Навальный.
Mark, what the hell is going on here? this is nuts. I mean, what's going on here? What do you think?
There is a pretty surreal edge to this, or whatever, which immediately then lends itself to conspiracy theory type notions of, you know, is this an attempt to in effect co-opt, if not Navalny, at least Navalny's campaign. I mean, this is the trouble. If the prevailing mood does become that the elite is the sort of party of thieves and swindlers and so forth, what do you do with that? And one answer is, well, you actually simply say that you are shocked to discover that corruption is so widespread, and we're definitely going to start doing something about this now. So, I mean, I think there may well be some aspect in which they're just simply with, again, we're going back to our previous discussion, actually recognizing developments that have happened, and rather than trying to pretend that they haven't, are instead trying to sort of get ahead of the curve. So that's one possibility. I think there's others, though. I mean, I think this represents in some ways an attempt to reorient the Russian elite. If people have assets, and often vast assets, outside the country, and in some ways have options that they could live outside the country, that encourages people to not really care about Russia's long term. And it also has this sort of rather corrosive effect on the reputation of the elite. It's a way of controlling the elite. Again, I mean, I get the sense that one of the lessons that Putin has learnt from the past year and a half or so is that he is precisely much less strongly embedded within the elite than he might have thought. I think he's coming to realize the extent to which they're all individual political entrepreneurs, and they'll support Putin when it's in their interest to do so. But it's not actually as if they genuinely have signed up for the Putin Forever sort of movement. And, you know, making sure that resources stay within the country is also making sure that they stay within your grip. So there's an extent to which actually it ensures that Putin can go after people's money, which is all the key thing. And the flip side of that is we've seen the Magnitsky Law in the United States, which will allow particular individuals associated with that terrible act to be not just barred from the United States, but their property sequestered. We're seeing pressure for similar or even expanded such laws in other countries. I mean, it's currently being discussed in the UK, for example. There may well be that some sense that in some ways you therefore Magnitsky Bill proof your elite, that if they don't have assets outside the country, then foreign governments cannot therefore put pressure on them by threatening those assets. But this is all, let's be honest, speculation.
Of course it is.
We haven't seen any real rationale given as to what is, it has to be said, a very surprising gesture. And one that I think is going to be resented. I mean, I think this is interesting. It's going to be. And whether, cause it might well be just another one of these laws that in practice is honored more in the breach. But what it means is that sort of 9 times out of 10 officials have their properties in Spain or whatever, and no one bats an eye until that 1 in 10 comes along who you want to use as a scapegoat or who sort of puts a foot wrong. And suddenly you can say, we are disgusted to discover all this property you have in Spain, and this is why we're going to prosecute you.
Well, I want to play on something you said earlier. You said Putin is very much embedded in the elite, because this is, to a degree, another example of Putin being a great tactician and a lousy strategist. Because what this has done is it's making the elite look kind of silly. Okay, it's making the elite look kind of silly, and that taint goes on to Putin as well. Because as you said, he is more embedded in the elite than he thinks he is. Right. At the outset of this segment, we listened to that that clip of Vladimir Pyetin, who at one time was a very, very big figure in United Russia and who was head of the Duma Ethics Committee. This guy is not some nobody, right? We listened to that clip in the beginning where he was talking about how he loves Russia. And afterwards, we had the clip of Navalny saying, how could you be head of the ethics committee and be buying property in Florida that you're not declaring in violation of the law? Well, somebody, of course, picked up on that clip of him saying how much he loves Russia, which is a promotional video on his website, and made a funny little spoof out of it. I want to play this for you, and then we'll play off of that. Let's listen to that clip.
I love Miami because it is impossible not to love Miami. I'm a Russian deputy, and like any Russian deputy, I own real estate in the United States.
I mean, this is what's going around the internet as a result of this. So we got Navalny just going bonkers on his blog, collecting, when you own property in the United States or Western Europe, these are transparent countries. It's very easy to find out who owns what in these countries, right? It's the law. It's transparent. It's findable on the internet. Navalny's got an army of people helping him do this. And, Pyetin's not going to be the last. I guarantee that. You got these videos making fun of, this man who was once a huge figure in a party that, was once Putin's party. Can Putin, as you said, if his strategy is to kind of be shocked that there's corruption in the elite and separate him, can he separate himself from the elite? Is that even possible?
I don't think so, but it's one of the tempting conceits that we've seen in all kinds of situations. I mean, even actually, if you look at the anti-corruption campaigns that took place under Andropov and then through into Gorbachev, on the one hand, there were ways of trying to sort of cow the elite. There were ways of trying to say, look, we have a new government in the Kremlin. But in fact, they were phenomenally corrosive because, A, they thoroughly angered and alienated the elite, who instead of thinking, okay, well, now we have to be much more abstemious, just simply looked for more and better ways to hide their resources. But also, it's terribly corrosive because it draws attention to the corruption of the elite. Now, there's a difference between, on some kind of general instinctive level, knowing that these people are all corrupt, and actually having it shown on national TV. it concretizes that sort of general prejudice. And therefore, I think that, again, you know, I do not see Putin as having that option of being able to draw himself apart, create his Oprichnina separate from the rest of Russia and sort of divide it away and sort of want to say, well, look, I represent the uncorrupt elite and I will be the hammer who will come down upon the corrupt ones. It's too late for that. If you might say Putin in his first term had said that, okay, that would have had some traction. But how can you just simply say, I will, you know, I'm disgusted to discover that the extent of corruption that's been going on, without having people say, the corruption that's been going on within your party, by the people you have promoted, by the people who have been around for so long. You know, this is it. Putin is no longer the insurgent. He sometimes, I think, still has this sense of himself as the semi-outsider. The scrappy guy from, you know, the Leningrad slums who is going to come and show these snooty Muscovites what's what. Okay, to an extent, he could play that back in, you know, 2000. But now he is not, I think, perceived as being anything different.
Well, that, and the interesting thing about all this is how it's played out. I mean, all of the attention has not been on this initiative by Putin to clean up, you know, the officials having property burned. And incidentally, this law is very limited. It's only specific categories of officials. It's not all officials. But nevertheless, the attention has all been on Navalny's campaign. I mean, it's just opened the door to Navalny. And I wanted to, we've talked a little about Putin. Let's talk a little bit about Navalny here. This is a man that is under investigation. There's multiple criminal probes against him right now. They're trying their damnest. The raid on the raid of Belik's office that we talked about in the first section was connected to a probe into Navalny. It was about the improprieties and a privatization of a local distillery that they're claiming Navalny was somehow connected to. They're going all out to try to pin something on Navalny. They haven't really been able to find something that they can make convincing yet. But Navalny comes out amidst all this, just with guns blazing. I mean, what's he doing here? Does he think is the best defense a good offense?
Well, that's always been his approach. I mean, let's think back to the Bastrykin case, when the Investigations Committee was definitely sort of ratcheting up the pressure, and that's when he suddenly blew the information that the Bastrykin had this apartment in Prague and so forth. Navalny very much seems to feel that the best defense is a good offense. Of course, the interesting thing is that it's amazing how far things have gone. Bastrykin was able to ride out that particular scandal. And there was no pressure put upon him. Pechtin had to basically jump immediately. And clearly, I mean, when we say jump, he was given the choice of jumping or being pushed. I think, again, it says something about the extent to which the political context has changed, which actually gives Navalny a lot more power.
Yeah. Well, the Pechtin case is interesting because now United Russia deputies are rallying around him. He stepped down temporarily pending an investigation into this. And his supporters are saying, well, maybe these documents from Miami aren't real. You know, like, I don't know. Are they going to start claiming that the Miami Land Registry has somehow been falsified in a, you know, devious foreign plot to incriminate Vladimir Pechtin. But nevertheless, his supporters are beginning to try to rally around him and turn him into a hero now. How do you expect the Navalny thing to play out? Is this strategy on Navalny's part to I mean, they just handed him a big megaphone and God, he got on Channel One, for God's sakes, or he got mentioned on Channel One in a positive light. I mean, I never thought I'd see that. How do you see this playing out now? We got the criminal probes against Navalny. They clearly want to get him. Bastrykin, more than anybody, wants to get him. You got Navalny, you know, playing this game. How do you see this playing out?
Well, look, to start with the criminal probes and then come back onto Navalny himself, I mean, it's interesting that exactly that they are so obviously trying to get him and yet have not yet made their move. Now, it could be that this is part of the theatre. They want to almost sort of build a sense of the sort of the gathering thunder before the storm breaks. But I think that's giving them far too much credit. I think it's more that they realise they really want to get Navalny, but they can't just come up with the usual fabricated, thinly evidenced case. That this is going to be a really big and indeed an international issue.
Yeah.
So really, they need proper evidence and a real crime to do it. So that's why I think they're desperately looking under every single rock they can think of in the hope of getting that evidence, which, again, is a sign of the desperation and, frankly, weakness of the Kremlin.
Yeah.
They can't just simply sort of lock him up and come up with three people who say, I saw Navalny do unspeakable things, and just use that as a basis to put him away. So, yeah, I mean, I think I sincerely hope for Navalny's sake that there is nothing under any of those stones, because certainly if there is, they will gleefully use it. But the point is, they can't just concoct a case. But in terms of Navalny, I mean, I think this actually speaks to something that we discussed some time back, that the extent to which the opposition had really lost momentum, and the extent to which, therefore, it was going to be the state that had to make the first blunder and in a way give the opposition their momentum. Well, lo and behold, here we are. This is exactly what Navalny needed to take what had been a, frankly, pretty moribund campaign that was really only speaking to the people who was already speaking to. Now, suddenly, as you say, they've given him this megaphone, and they've almost sanctified him as the unofficial corruption monitor in chief. you know, which is a tremendously dangerous and foolish thing to do. But nonetheless, that's where he stands now.
Does it make it almost impossible for them to arrest him now?
Well, I mean, I suppose they might be hoping that then that allows them to say, and look at this shameful hypocrisy, if they do find something. But certainly, exactly, I think everything they do that actually in practice elevates him also raises the standard, the level of evidence that they're going to need to be able to prosecute him. It's not like Udaltsov, who is still sufficiently marginal and, frankly, the West doesn't care enough about, that they can have this quite sort of shabby and shameful sort of trial leading to his house arrest. Now, with Navalny, they're going to need something really solid if they're going to want to have the show trial that they need.
And they, I mean, I saw this whole campaign against Navalny as an effort to co-opt Navalny's own rhetoric in a lot of ways. Now, Navalny, of course, as we know, coined the immortal phrase, the party of scoundrels and thieves, and they were trying to turn around and say, you're a scoundrel and a thief. And now they come out with this, which allows Navalny to say, you're a scoundrel and a thief. Their co-option of his rhetoric is backfiring because of this campaign right now. If you want to ask me, who do I think is going to pick up the mantle of Medvedevism, and it's going to be from below, I think it's going to be Navalny. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, again, Navalny's policies have been so much more narrow at the moment. I mean, essentially at the moment, he is a negative force. And that's not a criticism. I mean, that's the only place you can really be in the opposition these days to actually try and break in. The thing is that what the opposition realized to an extent and what the Kremlin doesn't is that actually the anti-corruption theme is not just about corruption. It's precisely about change versus not change. It's precisely about the legitimacy of the status quo and the need to move on. And therefore, even if, I mean, I have no idea whether Navalny has a strong line on modernizing the economy or whatever, but the point is, the more you push corruption, the more you are actually implicitly pushing the idea of we need a different Russia. So yeah, in that respect, I think Navalny is definitely sort of fulfilling that Medvedevian role.
Medvedevian role. We're turning Medvedev into, but I mean, I think it's almost appropriate, and I honestly do believe this, going back to the first part of our discussion, and I think they kind of merge on this point. I mean, these forces, I had never heard of Navalny before the Medvedev period. Had you?
No, not at all.
I mean, I learned of his existence during the Medvedev period. And it's, again, we've come full circle. The regime keeps shooting itself in the foot. In an attempt to co-opt all of this, again, they've elevated Navalny again. Anything else you got to say on this before we wrap up for this week?
Yeah, what strikes me, and I think it is the sort of the final point I'd want to make, is actually how weak the Kremlin is. And I don't just mean weak politically and so forth. It's that it's not doing all kinds of nasty things that it could. You know, if it really wanted to show that it was against corruption and wanted to try and co-opt that, then it shouldn't be waiting for Navalny to leak information. It should be identifying big sort of cases. And again, I mean, you know, a few million dollars from Skolkov, a big deal. You know, it could, if it wanted, launch a real purge. Just as it could, if it really wanted and was willing to pay the international cost, lock up Navalny with the flimsiest of evidence, whatever. It's clear that there is a considerable lack of confidence in the Kremlin at the moment, that however many tools are theoretically at its disposal, it is, and I thank God for this, not actually willing to go out and use them. And that's in some ways one of the most dangerous times for any authoritarian regime, as this undoubtedly is. It's when it's authoritarian but nervous.
Well, on that note, we will wrap up. That's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line with me from New York City has been Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Konchova, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week when Kirill will be back. And now, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.